Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador. How we love those half-hour time zones. 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Paris and Berlin, 11 p.m. in Jerusalem and Cairo, midnight in Moscow for all you Kenny Ball fans, and midnight 30 in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who like to move to Iran because you can't get enough of those half-hour time zones. But wherever you are on the planet, especially to our Asian and West Australian listeners for whom it is the early hours of the morning, it's great to have you along with us for another Clubland Q&A. You know how this works. Mark Stein, club members ask the questions. If you just want to listen to the show, anyone can listen. But you have to be a Stein Clubber to ask the question. Before I go any further, as you know, I guest host for three people in three different media. I guest host for Tucker on the telly, I guest host for Rush on the radio, and I guest host for Kathy Schadl, who is on the movie beat here at Stein Online every Saturday. And two of those three people are, you know, having a tough time of it at the moment. You know that if you follow what we've been saying here. That's Rush and Kathy. And please keep them in your prayers over the coming days and weeks and months, because they would appreciate it. And I am doing a little more guest hosting than I would like. So it is, I'm certainly attuned to what they're going through on a daily basis, and the ups and downs and all the rest of it. We will have a new Mark Stein show for you tomorrow. And also over the weekend, we'll be starting a new Tale for Our Time that you will not want to miss. You shouldn't miss it. It's an important one. And that's all coming up this weekend. For the moment, though, on this Friday afternoon or the early hours of Saturday morning, if you're in Asia or the Pacific, we get to it with your questions. Elizabeth writes, can you comment on the discussion of the preparedness of the Capitol Police? I think the reason they weren't prepared is because they never thought the right would act this way, but that doesn't excuse the lack of preparation. This also demonstrates that the swamp has no idea how far they have pushed conservatives. The question, if they can do it without consequence, why can't we, hits a nerve, may have hit a tipping point. Any thoughts? Well, I'd said what I had to say about this on Wednesday with Tucker, because, you know, I spent a lot of time in Northern Ireland in the bad old days, and I've been in places as I mentioned, Mostar in Bosnia-Herzegovina, where the Christians and Muslims had always got on well for hundreds of years until suddenly they didn't. And I mentioned that it's always, in a dark way, rather amusing to me when the authorities, a tactic proves effective for one side, and then everyone is surprised when the other side take it up. And that's what's happened here. We've had a political class that has explicitly incentivized this. Kamala Harris did. We've had congressmen who've actually been on camera urging people to get into the face of right-wingers, so-called, or Trump supporters, so-called, if they happen to see them in the restaurant. And you can't, it's ridiculous to expect a tactic that works for one side not eventually to be taken up for the other side. I noticed, I made this comment many years ago when in Iraq, in the Sunni Triangle, they were kidnapping Westerners and decapitating them, and then posting videos of the decapitation. And oddly enough, next thing you knew, the Mexican drug lords had started taking up decapitation because they'd seen that it's an effective tactic. Now, what we've had since Memorial Day here is that people have understood that violence is a good way to get the attention of the state, and the state will usually cave to violence. So, for example, it's not just that statues were toppled in June, July, August, statues of all kinds of people, not just, you know, Confederate generals and Christopher Columbus, but eventually they came for Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and an abolitionist and a guy who ran those anti-slaving patrols where they helped slaves get to safety in Minnesota or Wisconsin, I think it was. And so they're taking down all these statues. But what was interesting is that the ones they didn't succeed in pulling down, the ones they just had to deface or throw buckets of paint over or whatever, then immediately the municipal council or whoever it was would say they would be setting up a committee to look into taking down that statue. And a lot of those statues then disappeared mysteriously in dead of night over the next few weeks and months. So people drew the lesson there that if you're violent, the state will bend to your will. And as I said, to come back to my lesson from Belfast and Mostar, it is quite absurd once that tactic has been shown to work for it only to remain the province of one side. Now, Elizabeth's asking about the policing. I'll tell you my own view of life at the United States Capitol. I covered the Clinton impeachment trial, whatever that was, 1998, 22 years ago. And I'd been in the Canadian Parliament, I'd been at the Westminster Parliament, I'd been in parliaments, various parliaments all over the world, and some of them have stricter security and some of them have less strict security. And when I got to the United States Congress, I was there to report on the impeachment trial for the National Post of Canada, Daily Telegraph of London, various papers in different parts of Her Majesty's dominions. And so I show up and there's like no one there. It's the first morning. I got there early to be sure I'd be there in case there was a big long line. And there's a policeman there. And I say, hi, I'm here from the Foreign Press Corps and I'm coming to pick up my press pass for the impeachment trial. And the guy said, oh, yeah. And this is one of the Capitol Police. He goes, so I want to know where I go. He says, well, you see that yellow police tape saying police do not cross just over there. And I go, yeah. He goes, just step over that. Go round the side of the building and the second door on the left. So I do as the policeman tells me. I step over the police do not cross yellow tape and I go round the building and I try to remember all his instructions. I'm in the building, wandering around in the corridors. I go wound up actually because I didn't know how things work. I wound up actually in a bathroom that's reserved for senators. And after a while, I've been wandering around there for 45 minutes. And I sort of get bored with looking for the room where I'm supposed to collect my press pass because I've just had the free run of the building. And obviously, in that case, I don't need any kind of pass. That was my experience of the Capitol Police. Now, in this case, they, as is captured on video, they actually open the doors and let people into the building. And that's interesting to me. We've had these people portrayed as domestic terrorists for like 48 hours now. And what that means is that basically it's an expansion of the term. Because as we saw, the police opened the doors and let these guys in. We saw them walking through Statuary Hall. They stayed within the velvet rope lines. They're very well-behaved terrorists. Somewhere in Raqqa, some ISIS guy is kicking himself. He's going, oh, I had no idea. If only they'd told I wanted to blow up the Capitol. And if only they had told me that all I had to do is stay within the velvet rope line and they just let me walk the bomb straight into the Capitol, I would have stayed within the velvet rope line. So we're witnessing here a narrative being constructed. But basically, you know, as I said, I'm from my modest and minimal encounters with the Capitol Police. I don't particularly think they're any great shakes. A lot of, you know, they have jurisdiction over, I think it's 2.5 square miles, these guys. And there are over 2,000 of them. And they don't strike me as, you know, people who expect that there's that moment. I'll give you a comparison in terms of a parliamentary incursion. As you know, a couple of years ago, A brave soldier, the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, Canadian regiment, not the Scottish one. The Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, Corporal Cirillo, was shot dead at the Cenotaph by a jihadist nutter who then headed for Parliament and came steaming down the centre block of Parliament. And the Sergeant at Arms, which is basically a Gilbert and Sullivan ceremonial office. It's a like a cosy sinecure, but you don't expect it's going to get real. He heard what was going on, and he grabbed his pistol, ancient pistol, sitting in his desk drawer, again, because it's a ceremonial office. And the sergeant at arms went barreling down the centre block, one man, and shot the jihadist loony dead, because he'd appreciated that at that moment, his ceremonial office had suddenly turned real. Now, what we have here, it's the usual, flood the zone approach to these things, is we have thousands of coppers who think they're essentially holding a ceremonial office. And unfortunately for them, because there were thousands of them, it didn't occur to them that they were at that moment where an essentially ceremonial and undemanding gig had turned real. And so, as I said, on video, they're letting the so-called mob, they're opening the doors to the mob. I don't know what that means. If you're invited in, if you're being ushered in by law enforcement, does that actually constitute a mob attack in law on the Citadel? Brian in Virginia writes, Mark, first year member who's a huge fan of the club and the Speaker in Chief. I'm usually the optimist in our home, but I'm at a loss with recent events to understand where we go from here. By recent events, I mean the total and complete disassociation from half the country, the media, tech, etc. I don't feel like anyone can carry our voice of freedom, and that has me extremely worried for the future of this republic. Not one court or legislature, state or fed, listen. That is a sad state of affairs. Rush had a great quote from John Adams, where he said that the country does not work with immoral and non-religious people. That really struck home for me. What a way to describe our so-called leaders. I don't think any of this is over on either end of the spectrum. Where do we go from here to get our country back? Best, Brian. It's never a good thing to be in the position, and I say this going back two decades to the Take Back Vermont movement in Vermont, over the river from me, in New Hampshire, which I don't think I really noticed until I think I was at the World's Fair in Tunbridge, Vermont, and sort of going through the 4-H prize displays. And I saw someone walking towards me with a Take Back Vermont T-shirt. And it did occur to me that by the time you're having to have the T-shirts made up, it's actually difficult to take it back. You should really start thinking about that question before you start having to hand out the T-shirt concessions. Rush was right with that John Adams quote, because a republic presumes virtue. That's what it's premised on. It's an act of self-government. And only immoral people are capable of self-government. And if you look at any other system of government, if you take a monarchy exists because the Queen reigns by divine right. That's the principle. In the modern age, you can sort of finesse it a little so that in Australia, for example, they tried to get rid of the Queen and she won the referendum. So she reigns by divine right and by virtue of having won the referendum, which is in a philosophical sense, a difficult straddle. But it's a difficult straddle for the Queen. It doesn't impose any problems for the people. A republic does. A republic presumes virtue. And that's in a certain sense true of any system of government. It's, my main experience is of constitutional monarchy in Canada and elsewhere. Very little is written down because it's all about norms. In the Britannic sense, it's about constitutional norms, and those norms presume the behaviour of gentlemen. And even though in the American system everything's written down, it again presumes the behaviour of gentlemen. So the Constitution is useless if you have people who are prepared to drive USB drives halfway across the state in the small hours of the morning to some polling station 3 or 4 hours away. And if you have judges and legislators who are too cowed to confront that question in the bracing, cleansing daylight of an open court hearing. The Constitution's useless on that question. I would say what is interesting is that all societies, people, you can talk about this and you can't talk about that, but in the end, all societies boil down to the same kind of system. It's the, George Orwell, as he says it in, there's the high, the middle, and the low. And whatever system, that's the way you usually wind up with. And the high are interested in staying high. The low are basically just people who accept the reality of their lives, and the reality of their lives is so challenging that they never get around to thinking, "Hey, wait a minute, it's the high who's doing it to this, doing this to us." And then you've got the middle who are trying to. Who have a slightly more egalitarian view of these things and think you can go up into the high or you can sink. I mean, these things have been true throughout most of human history. What we have now is the ability. What's changed, really, with the arrival of computers and the internet, is the ability to monitor people 24 hours a day. That's what gives. Control over individuals to a degree that no despot ever did. You'll know this, for example, if you've crossed into a quarantine area, if you've flown in from overseas since all the quarantine began, you're supposed to give a telephone number at which you can be contacted at any hour of the day if the government decides to check up on whether or not you're breaking quarantine. If you give that number, that number can also be used to actually identify where you are. So if you say you're quarantining in northern New Hampshire and they check the whereabouts of that phone and in fact you're in southern Maine, you're in a big heap of trouble. That's not something they had before. And that's why a lot of the revolutionary chitter-chatter is no longer quite as relevant as it was. For example, China became the dominant power really without firing a shot. They will get around to firing shots. They're firing shots at Uyghurs and at Hong Kongers, and they'll probably be firing shots at the Taiwanese in some form or other to celebrate the centenary of the Chinese Communist Party in June. But they took over the world. But that's, they reserve that for Uyghurs, Hong Kongers, the Taiwanese. When it comes to taking over from America or from the West, they do it without firing a shot because they recognize there are other levers of power. They use all levers of national power. As I said on Rush the other day, we do shock and awe. We do shock and awe in Afghanistan for a week or two and then the long, slow bleed over 20 years. And actually, that's how, this election went too for the president. There was shock and awe on Tuesday night for a few hours, and then the long, slow bleed of the days afterwards as these mysterious bundles of Biden votes came rolling in unmarked vans. And he didn't handle that not Trump personally, but Trump's lawyers didn't handle that really any better than we have handled the 20-year occupation in Afghanistan. But what we learn from this is that it's important to use all levers of power and influence. If you look at the left, for example, to the left, everything is political. They say that, the personal is political, the political is personal, whatever it is. So if I decide that I'm a woman and I shave my beard and stroll down to the local health spa and start showing off my wedding tackle in the ladies' locker room, that's a political act. And we laugh at that on the right. because we think that's self-evidently ridiculous. Well, it's not self-evidently ridiculous to the left because it's proved very effective. So they pay great attention, for example, to what a supporting character in a hip sitcom is like, because they understand that the supporting character in the hip sitcom is another front that you can use to advance your goals. And so, for example, their definition of politics is everything, every aspect of life. And there's no part of life where you can go to escape the left's definition of politics. And that's very useful to them. So, for example, they, by contrast, the right has this narrow definition of politics, that it's about finding some guy with an R after his name and giving him lots of money so that some talentless consultant can buy a lot of attack ads and drag him across the finish line every other November on a Tuesday evening. And that's a narrow and reductive view of politics. If you're not waging full-spectrum ballot battle, you're always going to lose. You're always going to lose, and the loss is going to be total. And, you know, where was the waste these last four years? The waste was the first 2 years of the Trump administration, where Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell suckered Trump and crippled his agenda. So they did nothing about, you know, they got the whatever it was, the tax cut. Paul Ryan took care of his buddies on the tax cut, and nothing happened on the wall. And so Paul Ryan just said, hey, don't worry about, hey, Mr. President, don't worry about the wall. We're going to get to that. But first we got to do this. You know, the left doesn't waste time like that. On the very first day this new Congress was sworn in, Nancy Pelosi decreed that this new Congress abolished biological sex, so that no new laws or proclamations by this Congress will refer to the words mother, father, uncle, auntie, brother, sister, son, daughter, boy, girl. Those words, they've abolished biological sex in the most powerful legislature in the world. And you think that's, and the right thinks, oh, well, that's not really real. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really, are you out of your mind? The abolition of biological sex is a huge deal. And if you don't think it's a huge victory. Whatever you make of it, it's a huge victory. And if you don't think it's a huge victory, you're an idiot and you're playing for chump change. That's the unfortunate problem there. Let's see, where were we go? Who says this? Douglas Neviera says, Mark, how do you see your thesis in After America playing out in the upcoming years of total Democrat control at the federal level? Well, the central fact of our age, Douglas, is that China is the dominant power. And as you know, I wanted the slogan for the election to be "Make America Number One Again." I think China, that if the COVID hasn't shown you that China runs the world, you're really, I put it this way, that we're standing, it's like the beginning of the Godzilla movie, where the sheriff and the mayor announce notice a slight indentation in the ground on the edge of town. And they're all standing in it and thinking, what the hell does this mean? And then the camera zooms out way up in the sky. So it's looking at it from 10,000 feet or whatever. And you realize that they're all standing around in the giant footprint of Godzilla, who's come ashore and has left his footprint. And the next time he leaves his footprint, it will be to stomp all those guys flat. But they can't see it because they're all focused. We got this myopia, particularly on the right. And we don't actually look at the big thing. So we're in now this insane situation. Sometimes you get, during transfers of global power, you get insane moments. So there was a moment, for example, in the 1950s and 1960s, where King Zahir in Afghanistan was the only guy on the planet being funded both by Her Britannic Majesty and by the KGB. They were funding him. Her Majesty's government were funding him because they thought he was holding the line in against Russian influence in Afghanistan. And the Russians were funding him because they thought he was advancing Russian influence in Afghanistan. And we know which way that turned out. And that's really what it is right now. So you, the American taxpayer, pay for the World Health Organization, but they do China's bidding. And that's what this year revealed. This year revealed that we thought all the time we're told, don't worry. You know, 30 years ago, we were told, don't worry, it's just widgets. There's no way you can pay an American to make widgets in a way that allows the company to be profitable. So all that stuff's going to China and it's never going to come back. And we're going to have the knowledge economy. And the knowledge economy was so good that we had insufficient knowledge to know when the knowledge economy moved to China, so they wound up making all the laptops and smartphones and the 5G and all the rest of it. Then we learned during this COVID that they make all our medicines too, and they make all our face masks, and they make all our... So there's never going to be a war with China, because after a week we'll have run out of aspirins and we'll all have splitting headaches and it'll be over. And that's the most serious thing. And I just wanted to have, I didn't want an election fought about rubbish. I just wanted for once, that's why I thought, make America number one again. Bring the supply chain home. Bring the aspirins home. Who knows what the Chinese are putting in the aspirins? My headache's getting worse. You know, and we didn't get a serious election. And now we have a guy who's actually on the take from China. And whatever, you know, this whole business, it makes me despair looking at this. You know, people are now saying, the Mueller report. Okay, not the Mueller report. That's come and gone. What's it called? The Durham report. Oh, that's coming any day now. But even if the Durham report doesn't do it, don't worry, because there's this Hunter Biden laptop investigation. Oh, yeah. This is waiting for Godot, waiting for son of Godot, waiting for grandson of Godot, waiting for great-grandson of Godot. So if you... The only interesting point about the Hunter Biden laptop is whatever you think it's got on Joe Biden and Jim Biden and Hunter Biden... Chairman Xi has got all those emails and 1,000 more. So, you know, I don't think the chances are much good in making America number one again in the next 4 years. Al Mann from California, I take it that is, says, Mark, I'm old enough to remember practicing hiding under our desks in grammar school in the 1950s because of the Soviet nuclear threat. Where do we hide to protect ourselves from the upcoming attack on our economic system, basic freedoms and rights? You don't need to hide. It's already underway. What's happened is we're having a serious close down. I think I said a few weeks ago, I thought this would start happening on January 21st. No. It started happening on November 4th. So Josh Hawley, simply because he objects to the certification of whichever state it was, Arizona, I think it was, Senator Josh Hawley got his book deal cancelled. I'm kind of amazed by that. There's not even a pretense now that he's certainly entitled to do that. You can do it for all kinds of it. Barbara Boxer, and nobody remembers the little petite brunette extremist from California until a few years ago. I had the pleasure of being in a three-way squeeze with her and Strom Thurmond in the United States Senate long ago. Delightful lady, if you don't mind all the crazy left-wing extremism. But Barbara Boxer did this and nobody cancelled her book deal, and it would have been regarded as outrageous if they had. David Kelly Wood says, Mark, I'm trying to anticipate Some of the changes we can expect under one-party rule. One might be with the Pledge of Allegiance, since the flag is an object of scorn. The states are not united. The Republic has been rendered irrelevant, and under God and with liberty and justice for all has been inapplicable for some time. Perhaps going forward, simply I pledge allegiance should pretty much cover what the Democrats will require us, right? Well, there's always a flip when the control changes hands in Washington. So, for example, under Bush, it was all dissent is patriotic. Dissent is the highest form of patriotism. Then Obama gets elected and dissent is racist. Then Trump gets elected and dissent is back in power again, and suddenly the dissenters are the resistance, absolutely repulsive form of cultural, genuinely repulsive form of cultural appropriation, because you can say what you like about the French resistance, but that required bravery on the part of those individuals who were part of the Maquis. And a few months ago, I went and visited I just came across it, actually, in the middle of nowhere on a hill in a ruined and abandoned village where the Maquis, it was an old medieval village on the top of the hill. The soil had never been much good and the village had died over the centuries. And the Maquis had been holed up there until the Gestapo found out where they were. There's no Gestapo here. You could be in the resistance and go on television. Well, if you're in a resistance that goes on television, it's not a resistance. But now it's flipped again. So all resistance now is racist, and 75 million people. You're basically, what's the phrase they apply to those guys who were let in by the police at the Capitol? Domestic terrorists. Domestic terrorists. So the 75 million people who are basically domestic terrorists on probation. Good luck with that. Gregory Lawton says, what has me concerned is the reaction of our country's enemies to current events in DC, which our collective leadership projects a combination of weakness and stupidity. President Xi has been patiently waiting for the opportune time to seize Taiwan. Iran wants to blow up Tel Aviv. Kim Jong-un can't wait to try out his new nuclear warheads. And Putin wants to re-establish the USSR. Something is going to blow up, figuratively or literally, during the Biden administration. Do you have any guesses? Well, a lot of those things are possible. I mentioned earlier the centenary of the Chinese Communist Party. You know, some communist parties, like the Russians, they didn't make it to the 100th birthday and celebrating and still being in power. But Chairman Xi did, and he is going to want to celebrate that with something big. So I would say, you know, the fact of the matter is they've come a long way over the last 30, 40 years, just on the sly. But they're getting more and more upfront about what their big goals are, and they're in a hurry. So I would bet, I would think Chairman Xi is the way to bet on that one. Tom Lewis says, so what are the odds that Mitt Romney or Lisa Murkowski decide to caucus with the Dems? Well, you don't seem to be watching the telly, Tom, because they're all telling us that you don't need to worry about this 50-50 set, because Joe Manchin from West Virginia, he's not going to go along with all this, you know, court packing and making Puerto Rico a state and any of this nonsense. Yeah, so we're betting the Republic now on Joe Manchin, the so-called moderate Democrat. Have you noticed, actually, have you actually got any evidence from recent years of his moderation, so-called? I would imagine that when he actually comes to vote for any of these things, he will vote with his party, because he's a loyalist. Because there's nothing for you in being a dissenting Democrat. You know, you don't get any strange new respect from the Washington media or anything. And so he's keeping that. He's just dangling that. He's just doing a little bit of teasing. He's just twirling his moderate tassels around, but he's not actually gonna go the full reveal on that moderation. And in fact, you know, it is more likely. I could see, for example, I'm not sure what cabinet positions are available to be given out, but I could see that an explicitly anti-Trump senator could certainly be persuaded, in fact, not just to caucus with the Dems, but to serve in the Biden administration. Michael Covino writes, Mark, I must applaud you for being prescient in laying out, or as I think they say in the United States, I'm so honest, I'm disassimilating by the day. I think they say, isn't the American pronunciation prescient? Prescient? I always say prescient. I must applaud you, prescient, whichever, take your fancy. I must applaud you for being prescient. I was insufficiently prescient to foresee that when I got here, the pronunciation would be prescient. I must applaud you for being prescient in laying out what the left would do if Biden won and captured the Georgia Senate seats. However, the speed at which they are acting is just breathtaking. How bad do you think it's going to get when it comes to free speech? Also, what are your thoughts on the theory that the Dems are rushing to impeach and convict Trump prior to January the 20th? Because A, they fear his potential as a candidate in 2024, and B, worry he is about to declassify tons of documents regarding Biden, et al. Thanks for being a guiding light in this bleak period, says Michael Covino. You know, people criticize. I took a vow, really, on the morning of November the 4th, because I was sort of exhausted by all that. Let me back up a bit. I find if you're interested in the big picture, two-year election campaigns are a complete bloody bore. They can bore me more. Because if you think, for example, the biggest challenge of our times is that Western civilization is sliding off a cliff, having to pretend to be interested in whether Beto O'Rourke is up 2 points in Iowa is a complete waste of your time. And so under this system, politics becomes just about politicians. We don't talk about any issues over the two-year campaign. We just talk about personalities. And I find that, frankly, a crashing bore and a huge problem in the system. One that certainly the founders did not intend. As you know, for most of the early years of the Republic, the presidential candidate did not campaign because the view was that the office sought the man. The man did not seek the office. We've completely perverted that with results that you see to this day. And so my view was that I'll stagger on. I'll pretend to be interested in all this about whether, you know, Cory Booker is doing well at the New Hampshire pancake flip. I'll pretend to be interested in that. But on the morning of November the 4th, when my view was that Trump would win narrowly, and the only question was whether he would win narrowly enough to be beyond the margin of fraud, or as the margin of lawyer, as I quaintly called it in the old days, and that November the 4th we could get back to talking about something important. That didn't happen, and so I thought, we're going to see how this plays out, and whichever way it does, I'm going to hold off on the bloodletting until January the 20th, once we see who's actually taken the oath of office, because the bloodletting is going to be terrible in this business, because the never-Trumpers think they've proved their point now and they're all ready to come back and retake the party. And so on November, in the early hours of November 4th, as I think I wrote today, the Dems made it plain that Trump was no longer going to be president. What they've done this last week is decided that it's not enough for him not to be president. They don't want him to be a former president either. They don't want the Grover Cleveland scenario where he comes back in 4 years. So it's important to them, as I said this morning, that he be the most ex ex-president ever, as more ex than Nixon. Nixon they still invited to the when they have these photo ops in the Oval Office where all the presidents get together and stand round the desk with the incumbent. They're not going to be inviting Trump to that. They want Trump to be an ex-president. They want to put him in jail. The reason we now have Schumer and Pelosi, again, this is the never let a crisis go to waste. You know, the Paul Ryan view of conservatism is never let a victory amount to anything, whereas the Democrats' view is never let a crisis go to waste. So they weaponized, they seized their moment with what happened at the Capitol on Wednesday, and they are determined to make Trump the most ex-president in American history. That means they won't. They would like him not to serve out his term. And so if Pence will not invoke the 25th Amendment, they're going to impeach him. And what was interesting to me is I start getting hearing, I'm not particularly plugged in, I'm out of the loop with a lot of this stuff, but I suddenly start hearing about some of the senators whose names have been mentioned. Your Mitt Romneys, your Lisa Murkowskis, your Ben Sasse and your Susan Collins and this and that and the other, maybe thinking that this time round, if they re-impeach the president in super fast time, maybe these guys will go along with it and get him out. And, you know, they're determined that if he is impeached and convicted, he can't run again. But they're determined to inflict enough damage that he won't be able to run again, and that the minute he leaves office, now he's going out. He's going on the 19th. He's leaving a day early. The entire family are flying to Mar-a-Lago. And we're told this is because he wants to be able to fly out on Air Force One, whereas the departing president on the 20th usually leaves on what's designated as Air Force Two. You know, I don't know. If I were him, I would fly on my own plane because I'm not sure I'd entirely trust anyone, anything operated by the federal government, if you know what I mean. So he's going to be leaving on the 19th, and they are determined then, they actually would like to get him in jail. The guy, the district attorney in New York would like to put Trump in jail. The Supreme Ayatollah in Iran, the Iranian government has just filed charges against Trump for murdering Soleimani a year ago. And I don't entirely rule out Biden extraditing Trump to be hanged on a scaffold in the middle of Tehran. I wouldn't entirely rule that out. Because you see from what Pelosi and Schumer are doing that what matters to them, it's nothing to do with Trump. It's way beyond Trump. It's to teach you guys the lesson. The same lesson that the European Union has tried to teach some of its member states, that you can't do this, that the choices between in the modern era, you get a choice between a left of centre party and an ever so slightly barely discernible right of left of centre party. So you guys, you losers, you didn't play by those rules. You supported Trump and you let him hijack the ineffectual, ever so slightly right of left of centre party that had basically has outstayed its welcome for whatever it is, two generations now. And that's not going to happen again. That's not going to happen again. So you guys were doing this. You stay within the house train choices because the Trump moment is never going to happen again. And Dan and Linda Phillips, just as a postscript to that, say, "Hi, Mark, you're a considered and thoughtful guy. Where do you see Donald Trump a year from now?" A year from now, he is going to be mired in some serious litigation in the Southern District of New York. That's, as I said, if they haven't inflicted something even worse on him. What is interesting to me is that, you know, for example, I was looking at Alyssa Farah this morning, who's a young lady who she's Joe Farah's daughter. I think I'd been on, I think, Hannity, guest hosted Hannity when Joe Farah's been a guest. And I've run across him from time to time. He was a big birther, actually. Alyssa is his daughter. and was a young and rather effective, you know, whatever the stupid title is, deputy communications director. But it was very interesting to me when she had like a 2 or 3 minute fox head. I think I followed her one morning. She was very effective at just putting the president's case. But now all these people, she checked out a couple of weeks ago. I noticed Corrie Lewandowski, for example, checked out a couple of weeks ago. Power bleeds. I mean, it's painful to watch this so-called peaceful transfer of power, because what it means for this guy is that we've just spent 2.5 months watching everybody abandon him. So it's like a slow motion Ceausescu balcony moment, except that it's like the guy is on the balcony for 3 months and they're all abandoned. He's stuck there on the balcony and they're all abandoning him one at a time. Michael Seth writes, mega prayers for Rush. And many thanks to you, Mark, for making the past week almost bearable. Now that all other avenues of expression to patriotic Americans have been closed, the violence craved by the left seems bound to continue and increase. We know violent leftists will continue to act with the support of our institutions, especially the media. But we also know, I think, that at some point a real backlash is coming. My question is whether you believe that backlash will come sooner or much later down the road. And what do you think might be the catalyst as well as the resolution? I realize that's a lot to deal with in one question, but is there really anything left to talk about? I don't know about that. You see, I'm not so... We heard this talk about the silent majority. People always... And it's never a good sign when people start talking about the silent majority, that the very phrase is 50 years old. So it belongs to a different kind of America. It belongs to the America that existed before open borders, before the takeover of the school systems, which actually is the most important thing. I would be interested to know, and I say this as someone who put his kids through the public school system in New Hampshire, it seems to me that there are very few red states that have red school districts. In other words, you have red states that have the bluest of blue school districts. In other words, whether you live in a red state or a blue state makes no difference when it comes to kindergarten, makes no difference when it comes to grade school, makes no difference when it comes to middle school. They're all blue school districts. Now, how long does that have to go on before clinging to notions like a silent majority, which I've expressed skepticism about, and I think that was borne out in this election. You say, we know, I think, that at some point a real backlash is coming. And that goes back to my rather mordant line that I used to worry there'd be a civil war, and now I worry there won't be, that at a certain point you've left it too late. It's never a numbers game. The energy is always with the people who want it most. And that's why people were shocked yesterday, because suddenly they opened the doors to the Capitol, and some people walk in and they go up to the podium in the Senate, and somebody goes to Nancy Pelosi's office and takes a selfie in the chair. And people were, the left and the media were outraged because they've taken it for granted since Memorial Day and in fact before that, that the left wants it most. You know, there's no majority for allowing 6'2" people with a touch of hairy chest peeking out of their cleavage and their hormonally induced breasts compete with your daughter in the Connecticut track events. There's no majority for that, but it happened because the people who think that transgender rights trump other left-wing constituent groups such as feminists, the people who want those rights want them more than the people who resist that are willing to resist. So no, Michael, you know, I'm not so sure a backlash is coming, because at some point, you know, I would like, actually, if there is going to be a backlash, I would like to see whether it's going to be a serious backlash or whether it's just going to be, you know, there's a point here at which the right has to think about it to itself, you know. And in part, as I said, I want, you know, my view was to leave all the bloodletting till January the 21st. But for example, I don't think there is much. I've been, you know, the TV shows I go on and the TV shows I don't go on. And it's odd to me that people are really going to want to invest an hour every night in the state of the Hunter Biden criminal investigation. Right now, the Department of Justice, which is Trump's Department of Justice under Trump's acting attorney general, is saying they're looking at whether to charge Trump for his role in inciting the violence of Wednesday. That's what the Daily Mail, you know, as usual, you have to poke around in the non-American press to find out what's going on. But at that point, you know, Trump's attorney general and Trump's Department of Justice are looking into charging Trump for the events of Wednesday. Now, after what we've known about what's happened to Comey, Clapper, Brennan, McCabe, Peter Strzok, all the other guys with the book deals and the CNN contracts, and on the other hand, you know, Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, all the rest of it, on the receiving end of those guys, what do you think's more likely? That Hunter Biden is in danger of prosecution, or that by the Department of Justice, or that Trump is. You know, John Maravich says there's almost a panicked mentality among some pundits to call for expelling Cruz and Hawley, that's David French, shutting down the One America News Network, Newsmax and Fox News, that's Oliver Darcy, and cleansing the Trump movement, ABC's Rick Klein. I predict the heat out in the open will die down, but a covert cancel campaign will be carried out with Soros-type funds to primary Republican Trump supporters in Congress to use financial leverage against conservative media and then to go after Trump supporters and donors like me. I'm not sure I see a question mark in there, John, so I'll take it as a comment and leave it at that. But the cancellation of Hawley's book contract is not a small thing. They're actually saying to you, no. These are the bounds in which you can exercise your free speech. It's like whatever it is, the elevator that Sean Connery is in. Diamonds Are Forever, and he's in the elevator, and the walls of the elevator are moving in to crush 007. That's the free speech world we live in now. The walls are closing in on that. Scott Barnhouse says, "Hi, Mark, I'm a last-day founding member of the club." No, steady on, Scott. The last day of the club isn't coming until a couple of months after January the 20th. I appreciate all your work, and particularly your defence against Michael Mann. You need to succeed. I would like your thoughts on whether anyone in America can ever trust each other again. The last 4 years have only accomplished that neither side has any trust in the other. The media are not trusted. Our politicians are not trusted. How can we ever fight an external enemy without a cohesive trust? And a country cannot survive without trust between its citizens. Is it possible to get it back? Well, I don't know whether it's particularly trust, but you have to have something in common. And there is nothing in common. Increasingly, I don't know what. I'm not sure. I would like it explained what the 74, 75 million people who supposedly voted for Trump and the 80 million who supposedly voted for Biden have in common. Now, obviously, there are lots of non-political people. But those people for whom politics isn't terribly important, simply because the left controls every non-political level. It controls the schools, it controls the mainline churches, it controls the sitcoms, it controls the pop songs. It controls, in a sense, the cultural air that we breathe. And even though so-called right-wing people are stupid enough to follow NASCAR and buy Chick-fil-A and watch the NFL. It controls all those things too, and is just equally more contemptuous of you, as I always say, than the guys who control the New York City Ballet. And what's interesting to me is if you look at the ratings for Wednesday, for example, when I happened to be on Tucker, Tucker got back his pre-election audience of about 6 million people. And that's pretty good. And I was glad to say what I said and be watched by 6 million people. But what was interesting to me is that because there was an ongoing news event, which was this so-called storming of the Capitol, 10 million people watched CNN's live news coverage of the storming of the Capitol. That's huge for CNN. So they won the night and Tucker came, whatever it was, fifth or sixth with his 6 million people. I'm just saying this. It's like I know it's a little bit inside baseball, but, you know, I've been in professional broadcasting since I was a teenager. So I understand ratings and I look at these things. What happened is that the 6 million are the politically engaged people who watch Tucker at his peak. The 10 million people, half of those are the people who never watch politics, who watch Dancing with the Stars, who watch sitcoms, who watch whatever. And suddenly they're told, oh, by the way, did you know the Capitol's being occupied? The Capitol, what's that? Oh, you know, that big building with the dome in Washington that they've got the politicians sitting around. Oh, really? And they're the people who switch it on. And that's a very revealing number to me, those Wednesday ratings, because, again, they tell you that when the non-political class takes an interest, they default to that CNN, that default establishment view of what's happening. So, in other words, they're seeing the thing framed in the left's terms, the storming of the Capitol. Edward Lake. I like this question. Edward Lake says, when your vote is negated by fraud, how does a law-abiding citizen ensure their opinions are listened to? Are mass rallies enough, or are the disenfranchised forced to adopt the riotous tactics of the left? Well, mass rallies obviously aren't enough because not many people. And actually, if you accept what half the Republican Party are now saying, if you accept what Trump's education secretary is now saying, if you accept what Trump's transportation secretary, Mrs. Mitch McConnell, is now saying, if you accept what Trump's social secretary is saying, we're in modified LBJ territory there. Oh, if I've lost my social secretary, I've lost the country. Trump's never going to be heard from again. So the Trump model of holding all these rallies, I mean, do you really want to have a Tom Cotton three-hour rally? I don't think there's going to be a lot of people for that. Or a Josh Hawley three-hour rally. I don't think there's going to be a lot of people for that. Or a Marco Rubio three-hour. I don't. So obviously that mass rallies aren't enough. It's Mrs. Thatcher's line was, first you win the argument, then you win the election. In other words, what matters are the 4 or 5 years, or in this system, the 2 years between elections. First you win the argument, then you win the election. Now, the left doesn't want to participate in an argument. They don't want to participate in a debate. They want to abolish all that. So instead, they're getting you cancelled and all the rest of it. So you're not going to have the opportunity even to advance the argument. There's going to be a lot more Josh Hawleys in the future who suddenly find they had a nice book making the argument, and then Simon and Schuster cancel the book because Josh Hawley did something they didn't like. There's going to be a lot more of that. But the thing is, if we're not even playing in those areas, if we continue to do this stupid, narrow, reductive thing of just, send money now to sendmoneynow.com and we'll drag some loser over the finish line, and that loser will object to Chuck Schumer's judicial nominations. It's not enough. You got to be playing. In fact, don't send money now to sendmoneynow.com. Look at all the billions. I mean, hundreds of millions were wasted on that Georgia election. You know, I said 8 years ago that if the $1 billion spent on Mitt Romney to persuade him to pretend to be a conservative for 6 months had been used buying a TV network or a movie studio, things might be very different. What was the question I said I wanted? Oh, yeah, here we go. Final question. Robert writes, Mark, you've often raised the question as one of the best regarding futuristic novels describing dystopias, that you're always curious to know how things got that way. Currently, we're living the how it got that way stage. Comments. Yeah, this is a thing about when you watch these futuristic movies and everyone's wandering around in these sort of tinfoil cat suits with glassy-eyed expressions, and the family's been abolished, and they're sleeping in pods every night, and then they get up and go to work like worker drones. And what's always of interest to me is not the futuristic dystopia, but how we got from here to there. And I said to Tucker on air a couple of years ago, we're in the how we're getting from here to there phase. And we now have, we're now fairly advanced in the getting from here to there phase. In other words, we live in a situation where, you know, millions and tens, hundreds of millions of people around the Western world currently have basic rights of freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of association, freedom of religion suspended. They exist at the indulgence of the governor in American states, or of provincial premiers in Canada, or of first ministers in Scotland and Northern Ireland, and of whatever they've got on the continent. And so actually, you know, my what interests me is not how we got from here to there phase is less interesting than it was, because when you can only leave your house with the permission of Gavin Newsom, when you can only go to church with the permission of Andrew Cuomo, when even as piffling a figure as the governor of Vermont, the very squishiest of rhino squishes, if it weren't for that boob in Massachusetts, when the governor of Vermont decrees that you cannot spend Thanksgiving with any person from outside your household, then you are pretty well on the long journey from here to there. There is pretty much in sight. And I'm sorry to leave it at that. The thought I want to end on is if you've been listening to American talk radio this century and watching Fox News, it's not going to be enough to do it for us. We have to have some serious thought on the right about expanding the terms in which we make our case to the American people. So, if you just think, oh, this is okay, it's a bit of a setback, so I'll just go on listening to the radio and watching telly for the next couple of years, and I'll keep giving money to sendmoneynow.com. It's not going to do it for you. It's not everything. You're at least be clear-sighted enough to understand the rubble that is all around as far as the eye can see, and to understand that we need to build a new right. If you believe in the destruction of the Democrat Party, for example, as I do, they're the most historically racist institution on the planet, and the only one that has survived. In the 19th century, they were the most racist institution on earth, the most powerful racist institution on earth, and they've somehow managed to survive till the 21st century. If you believe in the destruction of the Democrat Party, it may well be after their worthless performance. I don't care which type of Republican you like, whether you like the various factions that have manifested themselves in this last week. It may well be to draw the full logic of the Tea Party movement, the full logic of Trump, and say, no, we're not going to operate within the toxic husk of the Republican Party again. If you want to destroy the Democrat Party, the most efficient way to do it may be to destroy the Republican Party first and give the Democrats some serious opposition. I throw that out there as a closing thought, and you are welcome to respond to that thought. As I said, We will have a new Mark Steyn show for you tomorrow, expanding our view a little beyond this grim week on this side of the Atlantic. And I do apologize for not getting to more of our topics of immediate concern to our listeners around the world. Maybe we'll do that on tomorrow's Mark Steyn show. And then stick with us over the weekend, because we have a killer tale for our time that you do not want to miss. I will be sitting in for our beloved Kathy Shadle on the Movie Beat on Saturday. Please keep Kathy and Rush in your prayers and in your hearts, because they are having a terrible time of it. I'm honored to publish Kathy's movie essays here. She's brilliant at what she does, and it's always a disappointment, not just to me, but to the readers when I have to fill in for her. But we think of Kathy, we love Kathy, and she is the absolute best at what she does. That will do it for us. It is coming up to 10:05 Greenwich Mean Time. We've slightly outstayed our welcome, but we hope you'll indulge us for that, and we will see you here again very soon.